I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today I'm speaking with Joel Christian Gill, who's an historian and cartoonist and has just released the graphic novel version of Ibram X. Kendi's Stamped from the Beginning. The new graphic adaptation contains stunning illustrations from Gill, whose memoir, Fights, One Boy's Triumph Over Violence, was named as one of the best graphic novels of 2020 by the New York Times. Today, Joel and I talk about adapting books into graphic form, comics as a medium and not a genre, and so many books that have changed the way that Joel looks at the world. Reminder, our July book club pick is Watchmen by Alan Moore with illustrations from Dave Gibbons, which we will discuss on July 26th with Joel Christian Gill. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of the podcast can be found in the link in the show notes. If you want more of The Stacks, join The Stacks Pack. It's just $5 a month and you get our monthly bonus episodes, our virtual book club meetups, and you get to join a phenomenal book community that is The Stacks Pack Discord. We have the best time. We dig deeper into our book club reads, share recommendations. We even talk about reality TV because it is bachelorette season, people. So if you want to join the fun or just want to support The Stacks and make it possible for me to do this show every single week, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join. Shout out to some of our newest members, Heather Hoynes, KB, Sass Weber, Nick Burka, Dylan Flesh, and Joanna Fletcher. Thank you all so much. And thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Joel Christian Gill. All right, everybody, I'm so excited. I am joined today by author and illustrator and all-around great guy, Joel Christian Gill. He's the author of Fights, and recently he adapted Ibram X. Kendi's Stamped from the Beginning into a graphic form. Joel, welcome to The Stacks.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
I'm so excited to talk to you. Let me just tell the folks how we met because it's sort of a fun random thing and then we'll dive into you. So Joel and I met at the LA Times Book Prize because we were both presenting awards. I was just asked to present an award because I don't know, I live in LA, but Joel was one of the judges for the graphic category. So Joel's an expert and he is now my friend. And so I told him, I was like, oh, you have a book coming out? You will be forced to come on The Stacks and talk about graphic books with us because I know nothing about them and I know that people love them. So I made good. Here we are. Will you just tell folks a little bit about yourself besides that one tiny fraction of your life that I shared with them?
Yeah. So I am a professor at Boston University. I am the chair of the MFA in visual narrative. I have been drawing comics for about 15 years, I guess, now. I started self-publishing, slipped into history and drawing comics about Black history, spending lots of time, really spending my time thinking about how to tell the stories of disaffected people in America, specifically Black people. And eventually started telling more and more of those stories until I turned to telling my own. I speak nationally on the importance of sharing stories. And I believe that comics are the best way to do that in a lot of ways, because they're a sneaky way to teach people. So I spent a lot of time really talking about but I tell people I'm an evangelist for comics and that comics have the ability to connect to people in ways that we don't necessarily collect with prose. So,
yeah. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Southwestern Virginia. I was born in Martinsville, Virginia. Martinsville is famous for two things: racetracks and racism.
Okay.
it's just below West Virginia and just above North Carolina. So like in that curve of of Virginia. And I spent the formative time there until I went to grad school at BU. And then we moved to New England. So we were back and forth up and down until I'm in New Hampshire now, which I call Wakanda. I say Wakanda because when I leave New Hampshire, I significantly decrease the Black population by leaving the state. So, I always say that, I make New Hampshire Blacker. So
that's your contribution to the state. You're a civil servant.
Exactly.
Okay. So I read your memoir Fights and I have a lot of questions about that.
Okay.
But first I just want to ask you about when you discovered that graphic books was a thing you could do. Because so often authors come on this show and they're like, I had no idea writing books was a job. And I feel like because kids often are introduced to graphic books as like a way to get them into reading, I would imagine that maybe you came across this stuff long before you ever realized that it was something you could do. So I'm curious if my assumption is at all correct.
No, I think like most kids, I started drawing just like everybody else did when we were little. And as soon as I discovered comics, I started drawing comics. Mm-hmm. There was a brief period in my life when I didn't draw comics. I was trying to be a painter because I was going to make people cry with my paintings. I was going to be Basquiat, right?
Okay.
But comics was always in the background. It was always a thing that I really wanted to do. And it wasn't until I had a friend who in grad school told me that my paintings were trying to tell stories and failing, that I went back to the idea of like figuring out how comics work. But just to answer your question shortly, like comics was a thing that I like immediately saw and was like, I'm going to draw comics. That's a thing.
Right. Right. But did you know it could be a job?
As a poor kid in Southwestern Virginia, I don't know if I ever thought about jobs in that way. Do you know what I mean? Like I never really had an opportunity. And I write that in Fights, right? In the beginning, like people ask you what you want to be when you grow up. And I don't think I ever really thought about it in like a concept of growing up. It was like, I was so living from moment to moment at that time in my life. And it wasn't until I married my wife and we started like having kids that I actually had a thought about a future past like being a rapper when I was in high school.
Okay. So, the rapper.
Yeah.
So in Fights, you know, I read it. I loved it. I think that like the way that you sort of brought your story to the graphic form was really, I think it really landed. Like there was a lot of suspense in your story in a way that I found interesting, especially knowing, having met you and knowing where you are now. Like I was like, oh, you know, we'll see. And then I was really like, what's going to happen to him? Like, I'm so nervous, you know? And like the colors were so vivid and like, just like, it's like very evocative emotionally. I felt like I really felt like connected to as a kid. And then I got to the end and you have this little piece in the afterword that's sort of like, you know, memoir is not biography, and I changed things here. And I'm just curious about that, because does that change, like, does changing your biography to make it memoir keep it memoir, or does it then become more like autofiction?
I think autofiction is an appropriate term for Fights. I changed it mostly, you know, for liability purposes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not anything that in Fights that I would say. Like if somebody were to come to me and I'm like, you depicted me in this way, and you made me an abuser, I'm like, well, let's talk about it. You want to go to court? Like, let's do it. Like, that's the way I would feel about it. Right.
Right.
And I don't think people want that smoke. And so it doesn't, but I think autofiction is fine because like I combine people like G Money and Rook are like dominantly two separate people, but are amalgams of a couple of people.
I see.
So like, so for example, when I'm fighting Rook at the end and he hits me with brass knuckles, that wasn't him. That was actually somebody else, but it made sense to make him that person. And the same thing with G Money, like connecting with them and like having a cousin, like that wasn't happening, but it was just, it made sense to sort of connect them. And so like, just as in terms of forwarding and furthering the narrative. And so like, right now I'm working on a book with Don Lemon and we're doing similar things with people in Don's life. Like, one really simple and like non-controversial thing is like when he gets to high school, he's like super interested in fashion. And he meets this new girl at the new high school because he goes from public school to public school. And she's like all about fashion and she's helping him. But I'm like, let's just make that your high school best friend because it cleans the narrative up as opposed to having to alter new people. And it's a small thing, right? Like his friend is not going to be like, oh, I didn't ask him about that. But it's such a small thing that I don't think it'll be a big deal. So like it just helps streamline the narrative to keep you from having to introduce new people every time.
Yeah, totally. And when you mentioned before, like you were writing and adapting history and like some of your previous books, and then you switched over to writing your own story. What was that like for you? Was like, how did you approach it differently? Did you think about it differently? Was it more challenging or easier to tell your own story versus someone else's story?
I think, telling the stories of disaffected Black people in history and shining a light and uncovering their stories helped me figure out how to tell stories. Mm-hmm. Because initially when I started drawing comics, I really was failing, right? I was 100% failing and trying to figure out how to tell stories. And I started to draw a version of fights that was called dandelions. And it was a metaphor for like kids who like, you can't kill them, right? Like these beautiful little flowers that no matter what you do to them are always going to grow. And it was like, they're like, they always like grow. Like one of the original ideas for that story was to call it cracks in the concrete, like these little places where you could slip through. And because I felt like that's what I did in my life. And so I drew this thing. It's like magical realist sort of a thing. And it was a hot mess, like 100%. And a friend of mine who's a cartoonist, Jesse Lonergan, when I showed him like the 50 pages that I had drawn, and this was like before actually really digging into how comics work, he just flipped through it. Like he drew like, he was like this. He like flipped through all the pages, like just leaping through like 50 pages. And he's like, I'm 50 pages into this. I have no idea what I'm reading. Mm. And so like, telling the stories and adapting the stories of like Henry Box Brown and Bass Reeves and all these other people, like the story is there. The narrative is there, right? There's like, they have a beginning, middle, and end. They oftentimes have climaxes, denouement. They have plot points that like stream through their entire lives. So it was really easy for me to just figure out how to like organize that. And so that gave me the facility to then go back and tell my own story after like having some stories under my belt. And so like it helped me, right?
Yeah.
And it's actually the way I teach too. So I teach my students to start with nonfiction because I feel like it's easier to arrange things than to sort of build it from scratch.
That's so interesting. Okay. When we met, you were talking about comics is not a genre.
Right.
And I was very taken by this speech that you give that I know that you probably give a million times to every audience you speak to, but you're speaking to a new audience, the Stax audience. Okay. So will you do your comics is not a genre speech for us?
Yeah. So comics, so there's a difference between medium and genre. And I think because of the way in which we've come to think of comics specifically in pop culture. And this is a history that goes back to the 1940s and 50s when we start banning comics. So like in the early part of the 20th century, there are these like in like 1910, there's like this thing in Liddy's Home Journal, like comics are ruining kids' brains. And so when we get, you know, conservatives often have like a, they also often when they run out of ideas, they fight culture war arguments. And so
I've heard of them doing that.
I don't know if you've ever heard that. Some point in history. And so in the 1950s, we start seeing that, 1940s, we start seeing this again, this after World War II, We don't no longer have like a Hitler to fight. It's like, what do we fight now? Like, what do we fight? So they're, so they start to do this massive thing. This guy named Fred Wertham, Dr. Fred Wertham, writes this book called Seduction of the Innocent. And he basically says that comics are causing kids to be juvenile delinquents, all like a bunch of bullshit. Like, I hope I can say that.
Yes.
And so it goes down, right? This whole thing goes out. And so people start censoring comics. Which is one of the reasons why you have the term graphic novel and not comics. Mad Magazine is a magazine because they didn't want to be connected to comics because they were starting to censor comics. A lot of cartoonists left comics and didn't want to be separate, didn't want to be connected to the idea of comics. And so we leave it. And so we get this, like, so comics basically becomes superhero comics and they become juvenile based. I mean, there's some great stuff in there, but for the most part, they make them for kids. And so like for almost a generation, that's what we have until the 1960s. And you get the comic COMIX movement. And these people come in and they're just like, they were influenced by some of these early comics and then like hated the sanitized version that comics did. And so like all of this stuff, including the Comics Code Authority, which says that you have no sex, no drugs, no violence. And they say all sex, all drugs and violence. And so they start telling stories with like broader understandings. And then as these things start to influence each other. So the underground movement influences the mainstream comics. And so the mainstream comics get much more interesting themes. And so as that starts to happen with the underground comics movement, people start making stories that with comics that are really about other things. And so Scott McCloud in Understanding Comics says that comics is a medium, not a genre, because if you have a picture and you're in at a kid's birthday party and you put red drink, I'm from the South, you put red drink in that picture, it's for everybody, right? But if you're in Spain and you're having, you're having breakfast or whatever lunch is, because it's not, you know, breakfast, a siesta, right? So you have siesta and you want to have sangria and you put it in that same picture. It's now no longer for kids. And so comics is the picture and not the thing you put in it. It's a means of expression. It's not what is expressed.
Right. So it's just like how nonfiction is a medium for writing all other sorts of nonfiction stories or whatever. But like
exactly.
Anything like, could be a graphic or a comic. The content could be anything.
Absolutely. And I think what's really interesting about that, the way in which to think about that, it would be like going up to Stephen King and asking him what is his favorite historical fiction thing that he's ever written.
Right.
Right. Because he doesn't write historical fiction. He writes a specific genre within the medium of writing. He writes like horror and fantastic realism. Right. So like making the connection between him and sort of, who's the guy that wrote the Lincoln biography, like Obama was reading years ago.
Doris Kearns Goodwin or something.
Doris Kearns Goodwin. And when she says, I'm a writer, being like, oh, tell me about the last horror thing you written. Like, that's the same thing that happens to us cartoonists. That people come up to you and they're like, so do you draw for Marvel or DC? And I'm like, I don't really draw superhero. I mean, Angela Davis is a superhero, but I'm like in a different way.
Right. Right. So basically, I know this is like a very remedial question, but I said before, this is very new to me. I only started reading, I think I read my first like graphic book in 2020. I think it was Good Talk by Mira Jacob, because she came on the show. So I read that in another book. I might have read one or two other things, but that's like the first one I really remember reading. Yep. And people talk about graphic books, comics, and then manga. What is the difference, or manga? What's the difference between those things? Is there a difference? Is it just the same different words for the same thing?
So manga means comics in Japanese.
Okay.
Because of the disconnect between what floppy, the sort of monthly comics, and because Americans have a tendency to simplify everything and make it dumb, like we're barbarians in that way. So like the people who wanted to move away from and not be connected to the comics, which they thought of as like being the monthly superhero comics, that was when the idea of graphic novels came out. And then even further, Hilary Troute, who is a writer, she wrote a book called Women in Comics, and she writes about Mouse a lot. She's a brilliant professor at Northeastern and a friend. She says that, she says graphic narrative, right? Because like there should be some kind of, because comics isn't necessarily like, because people have an idea. It's kind of like people don't want to call me a cartoonist because they think it seems like less than. And I'm like, if you think it's you think cartoonist is less than, try it.
Right.
Like, just sit down and do it one day. Just go ahead and try to like take some like complicated idea and turn it into something simplistic. And so there's no difference. It's all comics, right? It's just different reasoning behind why we call it comics. And manga is just like that. And I wouldn't even say that manga is a genre in and of itself, because manga is so very specific that they have books that are made for businessmen. There's books that are made for teenage girls about gay boys at a French boarding school that's super popular. Like, those are super popular. They have cookbooks that are just manga. They have superhero stories or adventure stories. And so there's a really amazing series that turned into an anime a couple of years ago called Monster. And it was about a surgeon who saves a little boy's life. And that little boy grows up to be a serial killer and then starts killing all of the people that are in the surgeon's way. So he has to go on this quest to find this kid. And along the, like, it's crazy, but that's not like, it's not a thing that you would think about as like, you know, like a genre, like that's not really genre, right? It's like, that's like suspense and thriller kind of a thing. So I think, so like thinking about manga or comics or graphic novels, they're all the same thing, just different words for these. I mean, that was a long answer, but like, as I'm a professor, nobody's ever accused me of not being able to talk. So there's that.
Well, I have a podcast and all I need is for people to talk to me. So thank you for doing your job. Okay. I could do this for like hours, but I do want to get to Stamped from the beginning, the new adaptation. So people who listen to the show know that Stamped is like one of the books of my life. The original, the first one that he wrote, Ibram's like tome. I read it in 2018, right before I started the show. And I loved it so much. And I have read the majority of the adaptations. I haven't read the kids one, but I did read Jason Reynolds. I've read yours.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering sort of like, I guess the first question is, how much did you and Ibram work together on this, and versus how much was it him being like, will you do this, and you taking the stuff and like doing your thing?
I mean, that's pretty much like, we had like a little back and forth. People asked me once, like, so you get LOL text from Ibram Kendi, and I'm like, yes, because I'll send him a joke.
He doesn't laugh. Nice try. He came on the show. Everybody knows you're lying. He does not LOL. He's never LOL'd in his life. He's the most serious person I've ever had on this show.
He definitely laughs, and he finds the humor, and he thinks humor is important, and puts it in a historical concept about how Black people in general dealt with like this terrible oppression. Like, it's definitely a thing. Like, Black comedians talk about it. Richard Pryor was famous. Dick Gregory was famous for it, and so like lots of people were famous for it. But so he basically gave me a list of like the important things, a highlighted document that had all of the you know, like the things that he thought were important for Stamped. So he gave me that list, and then I basically built that list and added to the sections and like added stuff in there. And there's a lot of my commentary in it, specifically when the characters are talking, like when Angela Davis is like, I've had enough of America's like hope and like freedom. And, you know, like, I've had enough of this American version of freedom. And she's like, I'm off to Africa. And I think I don't know if it's still in there, but I think we may have taken it out, but it was one of my favorite jokes. And it was like, W.E.B. Du Bois is like irritated. And he's like, I'm trying to pull a Dave Chappelle. Right. And he goes to Africa. So like adding those little things in there was mine. And so like, I would text him like the pictures and stuff. Cause like, he was like one of the few people I could show the laugh. Like, I need somebody to see that this is funny. Right. And so I would send it to him. So like, he gave me free rein. And I think that's important for him, is to like, when he worked with Jason Reynolds, when he's worked with Nick Stone, is to let people take something that he's done and put their stamp on it. Right. Put your, like, Jason Reynolds's stamp is on the young people. Nick Stone's version is, her stamp is on that. My stamp is on this one. And sometimes when you're at a bookstore, I literally stamp them. So
I know, I saw you made that stamp. So cool. Can you make a stamp of me? I want a stamp of my face, like a real Leo, just a real crazy person who's like, can you make this about me immediately? Okay. But so I want to ask you about some of the stamps that you put on this book, especially one of the things that I know notice is like, you use like some Black slang on some of like the really horrible white racist people. And I was really curious about that.
Because
it sort of reminds me of Hamilton, the musical, right? Where it's like, you put like Black culture on like awful racist people. And like, what does that do? What does that do for those people and for the reader?
Well, so AAVE, I think, in my personal opinion, when we talk about American culture, we are talking in a lot of ways about Black culture.
That's right.
A lot of, and really, in like, if you think about it, we're talking about Southern culture, right?
Right.
Because when you get above the Mason-Dixon line, you have people who are Armenian, who are Irish. Like, I always say that there's this really interesting joke that I always make, that if I go to a cookout in New England, I never know what I'm going to get. Mm-hmm. But if I go to the South, whether I'm going to a white people's house or a Black people's house, I know I'm going to get fried chicken. It's just not going to be my mama's fried chicken, right?
Right.
So like, it's like you always have the same thing. And so when you think about that and you think about the quintessential ideas of what American is, it's like American is Black culture. And so like, in like making cotton matter, making like colonial, during the Salem Witch trials, some like colonialists, Puritans say like, that's mad sus, it's hilarious. Or like having like, a crowd of people during colonial times, during the smallpox epidemic say, yeah, miss me with that. You know what I mean? Like, that's funny. That's funny to me. Like, it's just a right. funny thing. That anachronistic language, I think, adds a humor to the book because it's a slog, right? Like reading this history, and I say depressing, it's informative. But it's depressing, not because like Ibram wrote this depressing. It's just that the history of racist ideas is you can see it coming,
yes,
right? You can
yes.
see the cyclical thing. Like when I don't know if you read 12 Years a Slave, but when I first read that book, I had to put it down twice because I was so angry that this had happened to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't want people to read Stamped and feel that same way. I wanted them to laugh out loud, even when it was funny, not funny. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And who do you imagine that your audience is for this book?
Everybody. I think legitimately, I wrote it so that I wrote this book so that there are people who are like academics who would read this and be like, oh, that's really interesting. And kids would read this and go, oh, that's really funny. And everybody in between who wouldn't necessarily read a 579 page history tome would pick up a graphic novel and read it and sort of like, pour themselves into these ideas. Because what's interesting about how comics work, and comics are a sneaky way to teach people stuff. And because those simplistic little people, we can pour ourselves in them. The more simplistic they are, the more abstract they are, the less specific they become, the more likely we can pour ourselves into them.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody always wants a brown thumbs up, right? When they're like sending an emoji, but nobody asks for a brown smiley face because it's weird. That would be a weird thing to get. We resonate with that smiley face. And so I think the closer we get to the smiley face character, the more we can, and it does build empathy. People do feel those things, and you can tell that people feel those things, and you can tell that they are building empathy because people keep banning them. The people that don't want us to be empathetic to each other are banning those books.
Yeah. Can I ask a really practical question about the Stamped book?
Yeah.
Why is it black and white? Is that like, what's that conversation like with
I think
comic?
I think that's when, in terms of the markets, like the literary market, like the adult market versus the kids market, I think there's like a push between like, sometimes you want black and white for adult market and sometimes you want color for kids market. I don't necessarily think that's still the case anymore, but it's also like a production value and it's like cheaper and faster to do it black and white. So I think it's a little bit of like, this is for the adult market. It's color. It's black and white, so it goes there. And so I think there's a little bit of that involved. I typically just make everything color, but for this one, it was like, we're going to make this black and white. And I'm like, okay.
Is that more difficult for you? Is it easier? What's that like?
I had to, like, if you go back through my Instagram, you can see where I'm practicing how to use black and white, because none of my books had been black and white at that point. So it was like me experimenting with tones and textures to try to get this. To make it interesting, like, how am I going to this? Because color is a really important element to, like, you know, add emotional cues to things like I did in Fights. So I couldn't do that. So it was like, I was experimenting with all of these ways in which to do it. It would have been really fun. I think it would have been really fun to do it in color.
Yeah. It's just interesting. We had Kristen Radke on, who wrote Seek You. And then she had another graphic novel that I can't remember the name of course. It's totally escaping me. But, that for her first one was black and white. And then when she did Seek You, it was in color. And she was saying that she did the first one in black and white because it was too hard for her to do color. Color was like very distracting and difficult for her because it felt like such a huge indicator to the audience and that she like didn't feel she had a good grasp on it. So she said she spent so much time on the color in the second book and it was like it's a whole other beast. So it's interesting to hear you say that you always do color and that this was like a thing, just, you know, different ways of doing it.
Yeah, because when you think about materials, like it's like, I taught color theory for a long time and I still teach it in aspects to my grad students. But like, if you need to go to the store, like I'm going to learn to paint. Remember there's this woman that I knew years ago who's like, I'm going to go paint. So she went to the art supply store and she bought like $400 worth of like oil paints. And it was like, you know, light, all these different reds, all these different blues, all these different greens. And there's like a effortlessness about just picking up the right green and just putting it down. Right. But then I went to a grad program and there was a professor named Bill White who was incredible. And I still keep in touch with him today, who taught me color theory. And he was like, you're going to use two yellows, two reds, and two blues, one warm, one cool for each one. Right. And that like you would think that would be limiting, but it actually pushes you to be more creative with how you use those colors. So I got much more color facility by doing that. So I'm like really comfortable with it, but some people just really struggle with color because of the way in which we see like women, on average, typically see more colors than men do and have better color vision than men do. And lots of men, there's like a Venn diagram of men and people who are colorblind, and men typically fill up that space. Not all people who are colorblind are men, but a lot of them are men. So there's like a difference in like how people's color vision. And so like how you understand those things. And it's really complicated because, you're dealing with, and then you add color and emotion and like society, like for example, in some cultures in Africa, red is the color you wear to a funeral. Right. Mm. And here we wear black, and some other places around the world, it's white you wear to a funeral. So like, you know, like trying to deal with all those color complexities, if you haven't spent as much time as I have, like digging into the details of how color theory works, and spending time, like we used to give our students color theory tests to see where they were on the spectrum and then teach toward the color theory test, how we were doing that, the color vision test, just so we could like figure out like how, because if a student had a red green color blindness, we would like have to teach toward that to help them figure out how to use the color. And so like we would do like, that's like, it's a really complicated thing. And I think it's intimidating sometimes. I remember a friend of mine, Whit Taylor, who wrote a book, Ghost, and she wrote Montana Diaries, which is one amazing little like journal comic that she did with her husband before her first child was born, and they drove through Montana and she's black and he's white, and she was like terrified of like going through these like super conservative places. I saw her at the Schomburg a couple of years ago, and she was looking at one of my books and she was like, I feel like the color in your books is just like so amazing. And I'm like, I feel stupid when it comes to color sometimes, right? Because you just don't know. But yeah, it's just like levels to this.
Okay. Levels to it. I have to ask another remedial question. What is color theory? Okay.
So color theory is the idea for how colors relate in art. So how color works. So one of the thing that you're probably most familiar with as somebody who doesn't make art is probably complementary colors.
Yes.
Right? Red, green, purple, yellow, orange, blue, and orange, right? And that's typically the first thing that people learn. And then they move through that. But there's nuances behind that. Like there's like color vibrations. There's like the Bezold effect. There's like all of these things where you can make one color look like two colors. Two colors look like one. Like you can do all of these things with colors. But it's all like about how you manipulate them and how your color vision works. Mm-hmm. And then your practice. And so I used to do this stuff with this stuff called Color-Aid paper, where you take like these little squares, and it was pigmented paper. And you take these squares and you cut them. And you cut these two colors that looked, they were close, right? But they looked really different. Like anybody with the naked eye could look. And so we would play with like putting colors behind them to make one color move to another one, whether it's a warm versus cool color system. Like some colors are warm, some colors it's cool. Depending on how you play with them, you can push them in the back and pull them front. Mm. And you can make things pop. I'm looking at all the books on your shelf and I can just see color theory. I'm like, just turn around and look. You got red, green over your left, over your right shoulder. You got, you know, monochromatic in the middle. You've got neutral colors, and you've arranged it. This is color theory. You've arranged this in color theory. You've got all colors in different spaces. Like you've actually arranged things in like neutrals and blues. And
thanks
that's
for
color
noticing.
Theory. Yeah.
I do love my bookshelves. Thank you. Okay. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, we're back. We're going to move off of your work and sort of into the books that you love. But before we do, every month someone writes in asking for a book recommendation. So I'm going to read to you what they asked, and then you're going to give them at least one book recommendation, and it can be whatever you want for based on this.
Okay,
this question comes from Sydney, and Sydney says, I'm going to Greece for vacation in mid-July, and I'm trying to bring only one physical book for the trip. I'm looking for something engrossing, but not too heavy. I'm an easy crier, and that's not the vibe I'm looking for at the beach. I'm a big fiction reader, but also love memoirs, narrative nonfiction, short stories, and essays. Recently, I've loved Lessons in Chemistry, Julie Otsuka's work, anything by Emily St. John Mandel, and There by Tommy Orange. Ideally, I'm looking for something kind of lengthy and currently out in paperback.
Oh, that's great. Which is going to be funny. I'm not going to recommend a comic. I'm going to recommend The Dead Are Arising.
Oh my gosh. I put that on my list and I took it off for her, but it was one of my books that I was going to recommend. It's so good.
That's such a great book. And like, I think that's a great book because like, not only does it like it flesh out Malcolm X's life, I am really fascinated with cults and like subcultures, and like the building of the Nation of Islam separate from traditional Orthodox Muslim is really interesting to me and very fascinating, and how that's permeated through pop culture with like the Mothership connection and like a lot of stuff in funk and like the Asiatic Black man in the early 90s, and like how that all dates back to these like the Black Moors and the Black Israelites and like I love all of that stuff. And it's such an in-depth story that it gives a much fuller picture of who Malcolm X was.
Yeah.
And I think it's just absolutely brilliant.
Okay, but I will say this. Sydney said she's an easy crier, and I am not an easy crier, but I will tell you, when I read that book and we got to the assassination of Malcolm X, I cried. I couldn't believe it. I literally cried, even though I've read, you know, the Manning Marable Malcolm X. I've read, of course, Malcolm X's Malcolm X with Alex Haley. Yeah. I've, you know, seen the movie. I've read a book about Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali. Like, I know the story. It was not a surprise, but the way that the book is written is so well done that I literally cried, being like, I cannot believe they killed that man. Like, I was so, I'm like getting emotional right now talking about it. I don't know that, Sydney, I don't know that you will cry, but for me, I was like deeply, deeply moved in that moment of the book. It's a fantastic book. I second that recommendation wholeheartedly.
Yeah, it's so incredible. Like, I read that book and was like telling everybody, like, it's one of those books when you read it, you tell everybody for like weeks, this is the book you should read.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it like, it really positions Malcolm, like Malcolm X is such of like a legendary figure, and it really makes him whole. Even in the context of the 1960s, being friends with James Baldwin and understanding like the understanding about being a queer Black man at that time. And everybody knew. It wasn't like he was hiding it, right? So like they knew. And you think about Malcolm X and it's like, oh, he was a Black Muslim. He probably was. But yeah, he was really good friends with and Bayard Rustin and all of these people. Like, so like there, it just makes them way more nuanced. Mm-hmm. And I love that about even like Malcolm X and his like, because another one of the criticisms people used to give about Malcolm X is that he was misogynist because of the Nation of Islam and the way they treated women. But even that is different in the book, right? Mm-hmm. When he's answering those questions at the end, he's talking about women's roles, and he's saying, he's bringing like a much broader, even closer to biblical sense of how women are supposed to be treated. And I think it's just amazing. Malcolm X is like, it's sad that like, how do you kill somebody who is that?
Yeah.
Who loves people that much.
Yeah, totally. Right? Okay, Sydney, here are my recommendations for you. I'm going to give you a recommendation that should surprise exactly zero people, but also I know everyone hates when I talk about this book, which is Gone with the Wind. It is the perfect vacation book. I know that you write about it in Stamped. Joel just gave me a look, but it is one of my favorite books. I know everybody hates me for it, but I love the book. It's a fantastic book. It's racist, but it's also a good book. I'm just going to throw that out there. It's paperback and it's lengthy, but you can read it quickly. My other recommendation is another book that I love that I recommend a lot, and it's Empire of Pain by Patrick Radenkeef. And it's about the Sackler family and the opioid crisis. And it's like about the conspiracy behind that. It's very compelling. And then the last one I'm going to give you is a book that I have never actually read, but I really want to read on vacation, which is Crazy Rich Asians. I've heard it's just like, it's a big book. It's like 400 or 500 pages. I heard it's a great time. I feel like if you want a beachy read that's like a fun read with a good story, you could do Crazy Rich Asians and have a great time in Greece. So those are my recommendations. Joel hates me because I recommended Gone with the Wind, but you know what? I am who I am.
But also, I'm going to be in July. So if you are reading, I'm going to be in Greece in July too. So if I see you on the beach and you're reading that book, I'm gonna knock it out of your hand.
No, you're gonna be like, are you Sydney? Also, she might not be the only person reading it, just FYI. It's still a popular book. Anybody else who wants a book recommendation read on air, email askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com and we will do it on the show. Okay, Joel, now it's your turn to recommend a bazillion books. Two books you love, one book you hate.
Can I just say a book that I love hate at the same time?
Yeah, no one's ever done that.
Asterios Polyp is by David Mazzucchelli. I think David Mazzucchelli is like one of the greatest living cartoonists alive right now. He got his like working in DC Comics. He like all of the Batman movies are based on his work with Frank Miller, like Batman Year One, and he did amazing stories. He's an amazing cartoonist. And he did Paul Auster's City of Glass. He interpreted that book with Paul Karasik, who is a colleague of mine at BU. But he wrote Asterios Polyp. And I tell people that Asterios Polyp, so there's a couple of things about Asterios Polyp that I think my students told me, and it sort of like it made me think about this in a different way. It's like, it's a white man going through a midlife crisis. Mm. And like, how many times have we heard that story and how tired we are of that story? Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that I don't like, that I hate about the book. Mm-hmm. But the way in which David Mazzucchelli uses the medium of comic to make you hear someone's voice, mm. right? Like between Asterios and his wife, Hannah, the word balloons are different. So when he writes Asterios, when he writes Hannah, you can hear their voices. Mm-hmm. The way he uses color, a really good example of color theory is to look at this book. He uses color to denote past, present, and future. Mm. He used color to denote different moods. And so like there are times, and the way he draws like Asterios very geometrically at one point at a party, and everybody has all these different like shapes. So think like Picasso people walking around, okay. right? And so then you've got Asterios, who's a paper architect, a architect who has no, hasn't had any buildings built, but he's a professor and he's like a renowned paper architect. So everything's on paper, nothing's built. And so he's drawn with like cubes and like see-through cubes and shapes. And Hannah is drawn with this, and it's blue. And Hannah's drawn with this pink, sketchy, like expressive line. And when they're having a connection at this party, those kind of concepts and styles merge, mm. which is amazing, right? Because mm-hmm. he doesn't have to say they were like that in a way that you would say they're vibing.
Right.
But you don't have to say that because you just show that they are actually literally merging, right? Mm. And when they have arguments, and if it's an argument where Asterios is out of place, he's drawn in her world. So everything is pink, all the surroundings are pink, and he's still in that blue. And when she's in his world, all of the furniture and everything else is geometric and she's pink in that little like sketch. So it's just like an amazing book that I love, hate for that reason. Another book that I think is just pivotal in the way we think about comics is Understanding Comics. I just think if you are interested in visual culture at all, mm-hmm. you really should read Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. It was written in 1992, and it basically just explains how comics work. It's really great, and it's really about, somebody told me recently, like when they read that book, every time they read it, they go to sleep and they just have dreams of Scott McCloud pointing at stuff in its surrounding area. It's an amazing book. And I think everybody should read it. Watchmen, I think, is really a fantastic read, especially if you loved or did not love the TV show. Oh. Like if you haven't seen the TV show, you should watch the TV show. It's the blackest thing I've ever seen on television. And it's like done in such an unobtrusive way. But when you read the comic, it is the perfect sequel to the comic. Mm. To take Rorschach's ideology, which Alan Moore was trying to make an argument about how terrible the idea of Batman was and how Batman was literally a fascist and Batman is a fascist and Rorschach is a fascist. And you look at the natural progression of his ideology as white supremacy. Mm-hmm. It's so great. Like just as an aside, Batman is a terrible superhero. Like if you are a billionaire, right? And you are in the town, like if you are a billionaire in Chicago and you care about Chicago, right? You want to fix Chicago, right? What do you do? Do you like invest? Like think about like LeBron James. Like, do you invest in a school where you can send thousands of kids and change the lives dynamically of like thousands of people by creating a school and giving parents like job skills in the process? That's how you fix a community, right? Mm-hmm. But what Batman does is he takes his money, his billions of dollars in research and investment to beat up poor people.
To become a cop, right? Isn't he essentially just a cop? I've never read or seen a superhero.
I mean, which is terrible, right? Because I love, there's some superhero stories I love, and there are people who have written Batman in such amazing ways. Like Batman Year One is great. Batman The Killing Joke is amazing. Batman The Dark Knight Returns is amazing. But at the same time, Batman's a terrible superhero, like absolutely terrible. Because he's based, like Elon Musk is Batman right now, right? And he's not doing anything great for the world.
No, he's only doing bad things. What's the last great book you read?
Watch Day Diaries. I think it was great. I love that book. You know, like that book won the book prize, which I think is deserved. It's nominated for an Eisner right now. So mm-hmm. if this plays before the end of July and you get a chance to like nominate go and vote for an Eisner, vote for Watch Day Diaries. I would argue for that. I think, you know, they're like, the best way to describe Watch Day Diaries and the way I talk about this book and why I love this book so much. I read it last year when we were in Martha's Vineyard, and then I made my entire family read it. It's a short read. So there are stories that are specifically about four different people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I get, the best example I can give is in college, I had to read Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood.
Okay.
And the professor who brought this, and you're laughing because you know automatically. Like, this professor brought this book in, and she was like, it was a class on the comic voice, and she said, read this book, it's funny. That book didn't resonate to me. Mm-mm. It was written for like older white women in their 40s. I was a 25-year-old black man. These women were in the South. They had like relationship issues with their mothers, problems with their husbands who were basically like wallpaper. And but that's not to say that I need that book to be about me, though.
Right.
Like, let me just be real clear. I don't need that book to be about me. That there's a certain segment of the population that books like that work for. Mm-hmm. It just stuck to me the same way that paper sticks to a wall without tape. Right? Not at all. And so, like, I read that book and it didn't connect. Wash Day Diaries sounds like it would do the same thing. It's about these four women of color. And it's about, as a black woman, you know, like about like washing your hair and like the rituals that are around that. And I don't have hair anymore. I choose to not have hair anymore. But like, I understand that. And I remember that. And as a kid, like my sisters and my mom, but that's not important. The important thing is that it's about friendship and about these women who have a friendship. I ended that book that thinking I want friends like that, right? Like who have me like they're that are that ride or die for me. And I think that that's the thing that I think you can get out of a book like that, because there's some books that are written for specific people, and then some books that are written for about specific people, but can be for everybody. And I think that's what's great about Wash Day Diaries.
I love that. How do you pick what you're going to read next?
Randomly. You know, like if I'm working on a book and I'm inking, I listen to audiobooks a lot. So I listen to a lot of like fantasy and sci-fi books when I like do that. Like I probably, but because I spend a lot of time drawing, I probably power through like, and I read, and I don't know if you even listen to audiobooks, but I always listen to them like two times as fast.
That's so right. I'm get through them. I'm really a 1.5 to 1.75 unless it's an Obama. The Obamas get a full 2.0.
Yeah. So like slow. I slow everything. I mean, I speed everything up so I can power through it. So I like, I flip back and forth between like something that I should have read a long time ago that I feel like I just read Angela Davis's Are Prisons Obsolete.
Okay.
And now I'm reading, I'm reading two other books. I'm reading a book called, I'm reading Frantz Fanon's Blackface White Mask. And I'm also reading He Who Fights Monsters, which is a D&D style, like a guy goes into a universe and it's like he has D&D powers and there's no explanation. He just got to figure out how to roll for 20 all the time. So like I just switch back and forth between like, am I in the mood to like be angry at the world and try to figure out what I need to do, fix it? Or do I want to just leave? Like, do I just want to leave this place altogether? Is this a time? And so like, I think it's just like whatever's happening in the world, I choose based on that.
What's a book that you love to recommend to people?
I recommend specifically to spend most of my time with artists, like, The Artist's Way, which is a really short book about just the process of creativity and powering through. To my students, I recommend that one and The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which was my Bible for a while. Mostly just because I just think that if you're not going to go to therapy and spend time in therapy, you need to like figure out how to be a whole person. And I think that that book is a way to help you figure that out. With The 7 Habits, because it's really like cognitive behavioral therapy in a book form and like seven little bite-sized pieces. And the Artist's Way is a little bit like that too. Teaching you how to survive as a creative. Like how do you decide what materials to use? How do you keep pushing through? Like a lot of us become professors, and how do you make art when you're no longer a professor? And it's like, you just keep working. Like you have to make this thing, the thing that you want to do, and be passionate about it. So those are typically books that, and then like, there's like a book, I can't remember the guy's name, but he wrote a book called Children of Time. And his name is Adrian and his last name is Russian and I can't ever pronounce it. But he wrote this science fiction book about this development, this society that develops from spiders. And it's so creative and just like incredible. There's a, this really short synopsis, there's a woman who wants to create her own version of humanity. So she creates a retrovirus that's supposed to like evolve monkeys over like generations. And she's going to go into like a cybernetic chamber until she comes out like decades later. She's going to be their god, and it backfires, and the spiders are the thing that actually get evolved. Oh. And so you watch this spider sit like the spiders, like
I have
it's
chills. I cannot it, spiders.
My daughter's the same way, but it is so brilliant. It's so creative. Like, I'm just like the way in which he just thought about like every single aspect of their society and like how they went from the like Enlightenment period to the Bronze Age to all these. It's so great. So great. I love that book.
Okay. This is, well, let me ask you this. Do you have a favorite bookstore?
I have a lot of favorite bookstores. My favorite comic store is Million Year Picnic in Cambridge. Okay. And it's like your favorite comics, like their favorite comic book store should be like Cheers, right? You go in and everybody knows your name. Like, okay. I go into the Million Year Picnic and it's like, Joel, you know, like I love that. It's a small store. It still smells like a comic. Like when I think about comics, I think of like the basement of somebody's house, and like wood panels from like the '80s. And so it smells like that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's amazing. And so I love that store. And then other bookstores, I just like, it's just like, I love bookstores. I, mm-hmm. you know, I go in like lots of bookstores. I live near Brookline Booksmith. I have an apartment in Brent in Boston. So I live near Brookline Booksmith. So I go in there a lot. Okay. So like, there's a lot of like little stores that I like to go in. I like bookstores, but also like, I love libraries. And I always mm-hmm. tell people that libraries saved my life. So I love going to the libraries too. Libraries are like bookstores, but you get to take stuff out and not pay for it.
That's
so, like,
exactly that's the, right. It's, yeah. It's a dream. Yeah. What's the last book that made you laugh?
Oh, you know, I read this little comic by Noah Van Scriver called Mountain View Terrace. So, like, it's a memoir that he's writing. And so like, it's like, we're about the same age. I think I'm probably the age of his brother, like his older brother. Mm-hmm. And so like his older brother, who's a mess, like in real life, he's like, he was part of Comicsgate, like these terrible people. And Noah is like the opposite of him, which is really, and they both draw comics.
Wait, what's like Comicsgate?
So there was this whole thing kind of like Gamergate and like there's all this other stuff where these cartoonists who were like super conservative, like right wing trolls. And they're saying like comics are too woke and you're turning everything women. And like, and there was like all these women in comics got their jobs because they were sleeping their way through it. And it's not, you know, that's right. Terrible stuff. Right. And so like Noah's not that, but Evan is. But there's a point in the book where he like sneaks into his brother's room because he wants to read Spawn, which was this like big comic in the early 90s that came out by Todd McFarlane, like all these creators left. But anyway, it was like a pivotal. I actually have one of the first copies over there framed in the studio. And so he like goes and sneaks the comic out. And I just like, that was like hilarious to me. Cause if I had, like, I would have been something that I would have done, like sneaking this comic and then going and revering it.
Right.
like sneaking off into the woods to read this comic. That was me. I would have done that. That made me laugh out loud.
What about the last book that made you cry?
What made me cry most recently? I can't think of anything that made me cry. I mean, things make me angry a lot.
Okay, well, like, that's the next question. What's the last book that made you angry?
Like, Our Prison's Obsolete made me angry. Yeah, sure. Mostly because, like, Angela Davis as, like, an icon, like, it's got to, like, I don't know how, like, how do you, like, it's weird to me to think about being right, but being angry that you're right. Does that make sense? Like,
yes.
She predicts these things. Mm-hmm. Like she said in the 80s, like Reagan was the worst president for Black people since like Reconstruction, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And people are like, no, like Black people were enslaved during slavery, you know, right, like all right, these right, different right, things. Right. And like, and then Reagan increases the prison population by 300%, ignores the AIDS crisis, creates like greed is good. And this like, right, this right. whole thing. And like, and so she gets to the, you get to the end of that decade and, or like now 20 years out or 30 years out. And you're like, she was right. Mm-hmm. And so like, yeah, I was right. But holy shit, I was right. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, so, I hate to be right about this.
Yeah. But listening to some of the stuff and like, and reading about some of the like studies about ways in which we like deal with incarcerated people who are system impacted, and that we know that there's a way to do it a different way, but we mm-hmm. don't because mm-hmm. of like late stage capitalism. And mm-hmm. that's a whole, I could talk for another hour about capitalism, especially predatory capitalism, but I won't.
I mean, I could do that. It's one of my personal passion projects is to talk about this stuff. But we won't. We're already 56 minutes in, people. We won't. Yeah. What about a book you felt like you learned a lot?
Stamped. I learned a lot about myself when I read Stamped. I've probably read Stamped 100 times.
The big stamp, the graphic stamp?
The big stamp.
He needs different names for it. It's like, I know that there was like Stamped and then Stamped Junior, but now that there's the kids and the graphic, I'm like, I can't keep it straight. I need different Stamped titles. So I call the big stamp the big boy Stamped.
Yeah. I mean, I read that and it, like, I think it actually hardened my politics and changed the way I thought about things. Mm-hmm. Mostly because, like, I think I had, like, we all do, right? And I haven't read How to Be an Anti-Racist, and I need to. And it's like on my list of things to read. But mostly I didn't read those books because I was working on the adaptation, and I knew that it was like, I didn't read Jason Reynolds' version, and I didn't read Nick Stone's version because I was afraid that their versions would sneak into what I was doing.
Right.
And so I didn't want to do that. But I need to do that. And so reading Stamped, it really opened my eyes to like I would read that respectability politics bullshit, right? And I would be like, yeah, Black people we need to band together and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps.
And then you
look at it and it's like, but no, right? Because we've done that, right? We've done that with Tulsa, and they burned it down, and we built it back up. And, you know, we built back, that most people don't talk about it, we built back up those Black businesses and things, and we still haven't gotten the respect we need. So when did we do things? Oh, it was about collective action. It was about recognizing that there's nothing wrong with Black people. Mm-hmm. And you know, like those things really profoundly affected me and like probably hardened my politics in a different, like it actually pushed me further toward, I'm not going to say communism or even socialism, because I'm wondering if there's a new way of doing things.
Right.
But like, holy shit, we need to take care of people. Mm-hmm. And we don't. Right. Yeah. And we need to stop. And like, you know, poor white people need to understand that these things actually hurt them as well. Not just us. Right. Not us brown people. Right. Not just people of color. Like that intersection of brown people and poor people, like these things are affecting them as well.
And even middle class white people and upper class white people. I mean, did you read The Sum of Us by Heather McGee?
No, but I do
you
know
should
a little
read
bit
that.
About like
you
that,
should read that.
That
it's totally.
How,
yeah.
Yeah.
And also like when affirmative action was white and dying of whiteness, like there's all these books that talk about this stuff. I mean, I had the same experience with Stamped. When I finished Big Boy Stamped, I was literally like, oh, I'm actually a different person now, because a lot of things where I was trying to like give the benefit of the doubt or like, you know, pretend like things that I knew were wrong were maybe not racist. It just changed my understanding of like what the word racist could and did mean in a way that like it wasn't a personal thing. Like it wasn't about an individual person being a racist 100% of the time, but about people being and doing and saying racist things and like racist laws being in place. Like all, like it just changed fundamentally how I thought about racism as like an idea, you know, like that, like the worst thing you could say to a white person is you're racist, even after they like call you the N word, you know, it's like, it just changed so much of that.
Yeah. And it's not racism is not a state, right? It's not like a state of being. It is a transient situation that we often all of us, right? Because we live in a society that inundates us with these things. We often find ourselves in positions to express anti-Black racism, anti-Asian racism, all those things, or misogyny, or, you know, homophobia or queerphobia, you know, like transphobia. Like those are things that like, because we're inundated, we will hold those ideas. And like, for somebody to tell me, Joel, that was racist, doesn't mean that I'm like, I recoil, right?
Right.
I like examine that and go, was it?
Right.
Oh, yeah, that was like, that was a racist thing.
To use your like analogy about the container for comics, it's the opposite. Racism is not a container. It's what goes inside the container.
Exactly.
It's like it could be the piece of, you know, you're talking about sangria. It could be like the piece of apple is the racism. It doesn't mean everything in the sangria is racist. It just means like you do have a piece of apple in there that is definitely saying the N-word. Like there's a piece of apple in there that is definitely against affirmative action in a weird way.
You need to remove that piece of that. You're exactly right. Because like the container doesn't mean that you're calling the container bad. You just like, there's something in there that you need to pull out.
That's exactly.
And I think that's the way we have to think about it. And I used to give this lecture called Racism is Dead. And it wasn't that racism was dead in its light. It was that the idea of racism is dead, the way in which we use that word, because people call me racist online all the time. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't think you know what that word means.
Mm-hmm.
and it's just not, it's, they don't, people don't understand it. They think it's some, they think it means something else. They don't think right. it means like a description of what you're doing. So,
right. Okay. We're so out of time. So I'm going to ask you my one last question and then we're going to wrap okay. up before next time. If you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
Stand from the Beginning.
Big 100%. Boy? Graphic?
Yep.
Both.
Yep. Gotta all of them.
Got to tell Biden to at least read yours too. I love it. Joel will be back on the 26th of July. You need to get your copies of Fights and Stamped from the Beginning Graphic and support Joel because Joel's so great. And thanks for being here, Joel.
Thanks for having me. This was so much fun.
Everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Joel Christian Gill for joining the show. And thank you to David Hawk and Felix Cruz for helping to make this conversation possible. Joel will be back with us on Wednesday, July 26th to discuss the Stacks Book Club pick Watchmen by Alan Moore with illustrations from Dave Gibbons. If you love this show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, leave us a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and TikTok and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirajis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.